Dharma teacher, a Dharma student, a practitioner, and the whole array of things that we all are in search of, this place of freedom. I am currently in a four-year teacher training program through Spirit Rock. I have completed 3 years. I have one more year left. But it is a historical and landmark training. It's actually training 20 teachers, and 18 of them are teachers of color. And so in 2020, we'll be graduating September, surprisingly September 11th, 2020, we'll be graduating. I have completed a two-year program with Spirit Rock also called Community Dharma Leaders, and also have been on the board of East Bay Meditation Center, completed a year-long program there called Commit to Dharma, which was thought of and taught by Larry Yang, who's one of my teachers, and is actually one of our teachers in the teacher training as well. So I teach not only at East Bay Meditation Center, sanghas around the Bay Area, as well as at Spirit Rock. I also work a little bit at Spirit Rock in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and I was having a conversation over tea earlier around that. But before I begin, I just want to say something about something that happened last week at Spirit Rock. And I really do want to give a tremendous amount of praise to Spirit Rock for being on the right side of history. This is the very first time, this is actually the second time, the first time that a full retreat for just African Americans happened was in 2002. And at that time, there were so few teachers, we only had 12 teachers from the African diaspora. Last week, we had our second large gathering, and there were 70 plus teachers from the African diaspora, African descent, and we had a week of being on the campus, on the land at Spirit Rock. And then the last 2 days of the gathering, we had 300 people come through the community center. We began with having a talk with Alice Walker, with the teachers, and we ended with a talk with Angela Davis and Jan Willis, who is a renowned Tibetan scholar and teacher. And through that whole plethora, and I think some of you actually logged into the Monday night event, we were also there for Monday night. So this was history, where we were able to have the land and be with each other. And one of the things I had a conversation with the staff about was that, you know how it feels like when you have when you go to a family reunion and you actually like your family? You know, rare, but happens. And you have those inside jokes that you tell, or those places of, remember? This is the week that, as an African American woman and as a teacher in the Dharma, I was able to have that experience. And it was such a gift that Spirit Rock was able to offer that to us, offer the space to us, and offer the staff and all of the interworkings behind. So I just wanted to share that as a deep appreciation for Spirit Rock, and that it is the residential retreat center that's here in West Marin. And I know some of you do go, but if you do have an opportunity, it's a place that you can actually land and really practice, cultivate your practice. So I'm full with that, let me tell you, after a week, 7 days, 8 days of that experience. And right now at Spirit Rock, there's a fall retreat going on. And Philip Moffitt is teaching, along with Aaron Treat, Matthew Brimsilver, and others. And something came across the email, and it was a poem that I'd like to share with you. And I have read her, this particular poet, before. Her name is Dana Fouts. And it is enough. It is enough right now to taste one moment of peace. Of course I want more, but at least the door is open. It is enough to draw a conscious breath and let my hands relax, fingers releasing their tight grip on things outside my control. It is enough to shed a layer of stress, as if taking off a jacket or a pair of too tight shoes. Ease of being has to start somewhere. This breath is my first step. And we put a lot of emphasis on the breath as that anchor place in our practice. And it really does allow us to open the door. It's one of the first foundations of mindfulness, being able to be aware of the breath. So for me, that happens to be where I land in my practice, where I come home to, where I, in the words that we said in our beginning chant, Namo, it's returning, a return back to my breath, so that I can find a place of groundedness. So this was Dana Fouts, It Is Enough. Faulds. Dana, D-A-N-N-A, Dana Fouts. So this evening, my talk, I actually entitle every, I always put a title on every talk, and this evening my title is The Tale of 4+2 Bodhisattvas. And you'll understand why in a moment. But let me tell you the kind of the genesis of me starting this, thinking about doing this talk on these 4+2, 6 bodhisattvas. And it's really because of what I am feeling and we're all feeling in the world today. How do we actually sit with all that we're doing? You know, this quote-unquote busyness, what we're seeing in the world, devastation, suffering, children, people, war, injustice, lies, all of it's with us. And I began to think about what I can do. You know, my wife just retired as a teacher a few years ago, and I used to say, you know, each one teach one. You know, just teach one. That's all you need. Just teach one. That person will teach someone else. And that's what I'm feeling right now about what I can do in this world today. I can touch one. And maybe that one will touch someone else. So I began to think about what the Buddha had set forth for us. And he was rather deliberate when he talked about the Bodhisattva path. And it's not an easy path. And I'm going to give you a definition of what bodhisattva is, but it is not a path that is walked on very easily, because it really is about how do we sit in our own places of suffering, and how do we also sit in yours, see it, feel it, approach it, and not turn away. So I'm going to give you a definition of bodhisattva. A person who is able to reach nirvana, meaning that sense of a state of enlightenment, but delays doing so out of compassion in order to save suffering beings. Well, that's quite a feat, isn't it? I mean, if you're really on the precipice of enlightenment, and you say, oh, wait a minute, let me stop for a second because I need to look out to see who else may not be on that path of enlightenment. How can I stop my own? In Buddhism, a bodhisattva is any person who is on the path towards Buddhahood, but has not yet attained it. In the Mahayana Buddhism, a bodhisattva refers to anyone who has generated bodhicitta, a spontaneous wish and compassionate mind to obtain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Pema Chodron speaks a lot, quite a bit. I just actually heard her this morning. She was on Oprah's Sunday show. I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, she has a new book out. But she truly does walk that path of the Bodhisattva, where she meets people in these places of suffering that other people return from. And in Tibetan culture, they call it tonglen. So she practices this way of being with somebody, meeting their suffering. So I'm thinking about this whole idea of the Bodhisattva path. How do we practice that today, contemporarily? It's one thing to talk about it. You know, the Buddha had many, many people who walked this path 2,600 years ago, without cars, cell phones, and all the things that are complexing for our lives. And the other day, I was listening to one of my favorite shows at 7:25 on Friday morning on KQED, which is StoryCorps. And I have found some very rich Dharma in those stories. So I heard a story about a woman named Maria Ochoa. And it struck me as exactly the living embodiment of being a bodhisattva. What Maria does, she lives in Arizona, near the border of Arizona. And what she does is she searches for migrants who have been stranded or in danger in the desert. Because oftentimes, once you have somebody cross you over, and if you may be ill or unable to continue the path or this sense of coming to the promised land, they'll leave you because they must get everyone else to their destination. And so what she does is she and a group of others will go out and look in the desert, and oftentimes they may look to see if there's birds flying around, to see if someone may be in danger. And she herself is a daughter of a migrant. They came over when she was 12. So she knows that feeling of the anticipation of wanting to get here, but also the danger of coming across a border that is unwelcoming. Her group is called the Tucson Samaritans. And they're a group of people who've just dedicated themselves to really helping the suffering. She's 70 years old, retired, and has decided that this is going to be her path. She tells a story of just complete disappointment, not being able to help often those who are in their most desperate states. She remembers seeing a woman who was pregnant and her husband had to leave her and said, somebody will find you, and Maria did. But yet she also is in danger of taking her to an authority or taking her to a hospital. She says, one of the greatest satisfaction is being able to help people, keep them from dying. It's the most important part. If we can only save one life, our work is worth it. One life, touching one, saving one, meeting that suffering person, wherever they may be. As I heard this story, my heart started to expand, and I said, that's a bodhisattva. She's dedicated herself to that. Not an easy thing to do at 70 years old in the heat of the desert of Arizona. And also the danger for herself. But she's willing to do that to save a life. Or maybe two. Maybe three. She's the first of the four bodhisattvas, Maria Ochoa. And you can hear her story on StoryCorps.org. And then as I was preparing for this talk, I happened to look in my set of books, and I had a book actually that I hadn't really looked through, but it was 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. 37. Never looked at it before. And interspersed with this talk, I'm going to read just a couple of these. So here's the first one. The body you now have is a rare ship of freedom and good fortune. Realizing that, one must hear, reflect, and meditate without wavering, both night and day. This life is free to is to free yourself and all others from samsara, the always turning wheel of endless cycles of coming and going. This is the practice of the Bodhisattva. So samsara is the cyclical effect of suffering. And oftentimes I relate it to being on a gerbil wheel. You just can't quite get off of it. The suffering just keeps going on and on. And another way in which the Buddha talks about these cycles is through dependent origination, and how once you recognize that you're on it, and it could take a breath, it could take a second, that you have an opportunity with your awareness is to stop the cycle by being able to see the contact when it's happening, so that the endless cycle of samsara doesn't continue. So this is the path of the Bodhisattva. I think many, many years ago when I came here, it's been a long time ago, I talked about a woman who was a true householder bodhisattva. Many of you may know her. Her name is Dipa Ma. And her story is quite divine and quite tragic, actually. But she's honored as being and revered as being a woman who actually was able to go so deep into meditation, so deep into concentration that she actually was able to, they say, go through walls. You know, she was able to go that deeply. But she had quite a bit of tragedy in her life. She lost her mother when she was 18 to a sudden illness. As a result, she had to take care of her young brother, her male brother. And as it's always done, when she was much young, about 17, 18 years old, she was married off, you know, as they did. And she was living in India. She was married, and through a series of miscarriages, she just couldn't quite have a child. And it really brought her to the depth of despair. I mean, to the point of this spiraling depression. And somebody had told her about a retreat center just over the border in Burma, which is now Myanmar. And she went to that retreat center, and something really miraculously happened to her. She was able to go very, very deep into meditation. But her husband said, "You're not ready. You're much too young, and she, you know, you're much too young to continue on this path." He was a businessman, didn't want her to do it. So miraculously, at the age of 35, she gave birth to a young daughter, 35 years old. But this daughter died as well. At the age of 39, 4 years after the death of her first child, she gave birth to another child. And this young child was called Dipa. And so her name then became Dipa Ma, the mother of Dipa. Another tragedy hit. Her husband passed away suddenly. Again, spiraling and spiraling. And the only thing she knew she could do was to get back to that retreat center. As a result, and this is a long story, but As a result, in her 40s, she went back to the retreat center. Her teacher told her, you can do this. You can sit here. And even though she had a young daughter, she recruited her sister to watch her. And as a result of her deep, deep practice, she came back and began to teach. But she came back to teach in a way that was really unheard of. First of all, a woman teaching the Dharma, teaching meditation. And literally, she was teaching it in, not in the retreat center. She was teaching it in her apartment. There was a line outside her door to see her because she had begun to get quite a name. And she had several dreams, but one of her teachers was Menendaji, and he had eventually moved his retreat center to Rangoon, and so she wanted to follow him but couldn't. So finally she got her sister and all her friends to actually be practitioners as well, so that they could actually come with little Deepa and she could continue her practice. She became so renowned that she began to study with Mahasi Saido in Burma. But the other thing that happened is her awakening, that she realized that she could touch others. She could meet people in her living room, in their suffering, mostly women and children, and meet them in the way of the path of the Bodhisattva. And as a result of her incredible practice, she became widely known throughout India and Burma, and Western students came to see her. They wanted to see who this fantastic householder was, because she wasn't an ordained nun. None of that. She was just an amazing teacher, an incredible practitioner, and a true bodhisattva. So Western teachers came to see her, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and others. And they sat at her feet and learned from her. And again, that way in which people coming to her were suffering, and she was able to meet it in that path of the Bodhisattva way. And when Jack and Joseph and Sharon built Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, as their first Western retreat center, one of the first teachers they brought over was Deepa Ma, so that other Westerners could actually get a taste of her, a taste of her Dharma, a taste of her purity. She, second Bodhisattva, teaching without concern, teaching as a woman of the Dharma, not very common, but fantastic. One of the 37 ways to practice being a bodhisattva. When you recognize and leave the negative places in life, mental distractions gradually decrease. Without distractions, activities of virtue naturally increase. The spiritual will grow as wisdom becomes clear in the confidence of the Dharma. The path beneath your feet blossoms in every footprint. To rely on solitude is the practice of the Bodhisattva. So again, as I start preparing for talks, I go to the dictionary, because I'm always curious about words. I just don't want to say Bodhisattva and have you believe that I know what I'm talking about. Sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. But the other day I went to the dictionary and I opened it up and I was looking for the word bodhisattva. And when I opened it up, I saw a picture. And the picture, and this is, you know, when you say you open up the dictionary there, the picture was of these two women that I know. Their name is Joan and Jen. They are two incredible women who actually embody that sense of being a bodhisattva. They are practitioners at East Bay Meditation Center. They have given their life to that sacred community. About 27 years ago, they went to a silent retreat. And Joni was sitting here, Jen was sitting here, and just kept looking at the back of her head and somehow fell in love. So they've been together for 27 years. They have opened their home up as a refuge for the Dharma. They have invited teachers like Tanesara to come and teach there. They have invited groups and deep refuge groups and so forth to hold their sanghas at their home. They have been devoted to EBMC for the last 11 years. They have created justice circles. They have had leadership roles within East Bay Meditation Center. They've been on the board of directors. They have contributed widely to earthly concerns. And at the age of 70 plus, they still trek every winter into the snowy mountains of the Sierra in order to have silent retreats together. And on any Saturday, you can pass by in Oakland at the corner of Fruitvale and MacArthur, and you can see them standing out with signs that says Black Lives Matter, because they've created an organization called Neighbors for Social Justice. They have given to countless organizations, have fundraised for people who needed to go to retreat and haven't been able to do it. And as white women, they understand their privilege and their power, and they're ready to be humbled in that aspect of being able to know that, not step forward, but actually stay on that path of giving without expecting anything in return. So again, when I look in the dictionary and I open it up, and who do I see? Jen and Joni. True bodhisattvas. In the truest of ways. It's been an honor for me to call them my friends, my siblings, my sisters. And they have helped me immensely understand how to be on this path. Not necessarily the path as if the Buddha would direct it, but the path today. Because it can look very different. We can sit on the cushion, as we do, or in our chair, and we can enlighten ourselves in this silo, or we can expand into the community and begin to each one teach one, touch somebody in that aspect of how do we grow together? How do we do this as a collective? I think that that's what they embody, that whole beautiful place that is an aspiration for me. I really aspire to that in my own life. They're the third bodhisattvas that we'll speak to tonight. Number 20 of 37 practices of the bodhisattva. If you have not tamed the inner enemy of your own anger, but instead lash at outer foes, such misguided action only causes them to multiply. Such action misses the true target altogether. Backed by your army of loving kindness and great compassion, subdue your own mind. This is the practice of the Bodhisattva. We are so attached to our own anger. I started to use the words, the righteousness of right. And in essence, that when I am so in that place of being so righteous, righteously right, that means that someone's got to be wrong. And there are times when we're so set in, right? Our heels are dug in, I'm right. And there's not the opportunity, as they say, to bring the army of loving kindness and compassion to bear. Where is that when we're in that state? And I'll go as far as the dictionary, the internet, whatever it is to prove I'm right. Statistically, I'll come up with empirical evidence. Is it that important? Is it important to hold on to that? And as Dana Fouts said in the poem I read earlier, how do you loosen the grip that we cling to? To soften our hearts. Because this is what the path of the Bodhisattva is going to require in all of us. To soften. To bring in those armies of loving kindness and great compassion. So we've hit on three now of these incredible contemporary Bodhisattvas. The fourth person I'm going to talk about as a Bodhisattva, I'm not quite sure you all know, but he is a dear friend and teacher of mine. His name is Larry Yang. And it's almost a no-brainer that he has those qualities. He has been a forerunner in Western convert Buddhism to begin to make the change that is needed in order to bring about diversity and equity and inclusion into the Dharma. Into 21st century Dharma. I've known him for close to 20 years. I remember when he was a younger man and still a student, and he had this long hair, and you know, this is well before he went to Thailand and became ordained. But I could see then, 20 years ago, his commitment to change. Hard being a change agent in a world that doesn't want to change. it's a fight, man. It is hard. I've long considered, you know, when we go through your metta recitation and you find somebody who, first you do it for yourself, and then you do it for somebody that you know, and then you might find a benefactor. Larry is always my benefactor. I send him loving kindness because he holds me in that same way. He has filled the spaces of my inter-narrative with fresh ideas. When I think that I just can't move forward in my own kind of trajectory, whether it is in teaching or whatever, he's always there to be, as Bette Midler said, the wind under my wings. He's always there to do that. I've studied with him in Commit to Dharma, which was a one-year program through East Bay Meditation Center. I have studied with him in a two-year program, Community Dharma Leaders through Spirit Rock. I've had amazing retreats with him. And he has been kind to ask me to be part of a team, a teaching team as well. And now I'm in teacher training at Spirit Rock with him and Gina Sharp and Leela Wheeler. He's a gay Asian man who is proudly out. It's part of his path of equality. And a few years ago, he was the Grand Marshal of the 2016 San Francisco Gay Pride Parade. He is one of the founders of EBMC. After he left Spirit Rock and CDL2, Community Dharma Leaders 2, he realized that there needed to be an urban center where all people could be welcomed. So he and several others started East Bay Meditation Center in the heart of Oakland, accessible to all, and has been running now for 11 years on a Donna-only basis. He also established the Insight Community of the Desert in Palm Springs, so he is one active bodhisattva. He has published many, many articles and periodicals in Buddhist magazines, but he's also the author of a book that I hold very, very dear, and that is Awakening Together. And for me, that is exactly what a true bodhisattva is about. It's not awakening for me. As I said earlier in the description and the definition, it's awakening for all sentient. It's holding everybody to that possibility that this is a point in which we can become free. That we can liberate ourselves from our own suffering and from the suffering of the conditions that beset us. In his book, he writes, "Beloved communities are envisioned as those that embody the values and love and justice in every aspect of their being, even when circumstances are difficult or oppressive. A beloved community assumes that all our lives are interrelated, and the social nature of our humanity is not secondary to any aspect of life." I recently had the opportunity to get together with others and honor Larry in the Gratitude Hut, which is a hut at Spirit Rock along the path. And so often when you go into this hut, you see pictures of people, but you see them posthumously. And I realize that for his efforts and for him being the wind under my wings, that we were able to honor him in the Gratitude Hut for being a forerunner in the LGBTQI community and in the people of color community. And he has given a lot to do that. And I've dedicated myself to walk that path. I'm not sure I'm worthy. To take that baton. The path of healing. The path of truth and the path of liberation for all beings, but I am going to pick it up. Because it's my time. He's the fourth bodhisattva. So the title of my talk was Four Bodhisattvas Plus Two. So, the next bodhisattva is someone that you're very familiar with. And that's Kuan Yin. In Chinese, the bodhisattva comes in many, many names. Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara. But this particular deity embodies the heart of compassion. They allow us to wake up without boundaries and allows us to practice not just planting the seeds, but watering the seeds of compassion. There are many people who chant to Kuan Yin. Recently, earlier this year, I went to South Africa and I practiced for a month at Dharmagiri, which is a retreat center run by Tanesara and Kitasaro, two ex-monastics. And the chanting to Kuan Yin was so powerful that I could almost feel the earth receiving the chants that we did every morning at 5:30. Every morning for 30 days, without fail. I returned my life to the Compassionate One. Avalokiteshvara Kuan Yin opens her heart and her hands to see the suffering of the world. And oftentimes you see a statue where there's many, many hands and eyes within that hands, those hands. She's saying, I will meet you. I will not turn away. The path of the Bodhisattva is just one of the 86,000 Dharma doors that we can enter. 86,000 doors that we can enter to free ourselves and to free others. And what I love about this particular deity is that everyone is welcome, bar none. The wretched of the earth is welcome. The highest of the high, noble people are welcome. Because the first noble truth is that they're suffering. We all do. So no one is exempt from this particularity of who we are. We suffer as human beings, as sentient beings. So of course, if Kuan Yin is opening her heart to all, we're all welcome. This entity looking very male, female, sometimes it's called they, she, he, very androgynous looking, is a protector, is timeless, is an open-hearted way of practicing compassion in this very crazy world that we live in right now. So when we oftentimes will go to a retreat and they'll say, let's practice compassion, I just invite you to remember what this path of the Bodhisattva really is. It's about meeting ourselves, freeing ourselves, and in doing that, we free others. Kuan Yin, the fifth Bodhisattva. And let's see, number 35 of 37. Over time, to passively adapt to one's own ongoing negative thoughts and actions is, by nature, difficult to cure. Mindful awareness is the only antidote. With alertness, attack the obstacles as they become evident. This is the practice of the Bodhisattva. We have a guide. We have a guidepost. We have a beacon. We have light. It's shining. So again, I said that there were four bodhisattvas plus two. We've gone through five. And the last bodhisattva is us. whether you know it or not, whether you want to step into it or not, the path of the Bodhisattva is in all of us. You wouldn't be in this room in a sangha if that wasn't the truth. I believe we are all awakening to our own innate goodness. And it happens moment to moment. Sometimes we don't see it. And then we namo, we return to that goodness. We wake up in this moment to that goodness. And we realize how in that returning, we then reach out. It's the cyclical part of who we are. It's how we live in this world without breaking down, without crumbling. We have an opportunity in this life to water the seeds of compassion and love, non-harming, meeting suffering right here. Not turning away. I know that we can become so inundated with all that's happening in the news. And it's so much anymore that all I oftentimes want to do is click it off, turn away, and run the other way. It's natural to want to do that. And I'm not saying that's not a good coping mechanism. Right? Against everything that's coming at us. But when you see suffering, be the protector. Water those seeds. Be a spiritual warrior in your own right. And you don't even have to tell anybody. You could actually be a bodhisattva by just offering metta to someone that you see on the street or in your family or in the world. That's the path. You can eliminate the negative thoughts and actions as some of these steps called for. That's the practice of the bodhisattva. So I have a question for you. In what ways can you envision being a spiritual warrior, committed to the freedom and liberation and non-suffering of all beings? What's that look like for you? How would you, as Dana Fouts says, take off the cloak? Take those shoes that are too tight off and actually stand barefooted in the power of compassion. How would that be for you? I think we're all spiritual warriors. We wouldn't be in this room if we weren't. You wouldn't be touching into the most intimate part of yourself, the breath, body, heart. Calming the mind if you weren't a spiritual warrior. You wouldn't care for each other, your families, the Sangha, the world, the globe, our climate, if you weren't spiritual warriors. We can repeat a mantra as in Namo Kuan Yin Yin Su Pat Su Pusa. You can repeat it over and over again, but it doesn't necessarily resonate until you do something. Returning. Return back to the heart of compassion, the path of the Bodhisattva. So in the next few minutes, I want to ask you this question and see where you all are at. I know we have a handheld mic. So I'm going to ask the question again and just get a few responses. In what way can you envision being a spiritual warrior? Committed to the freedom, liberation, and non-harming of all beings. Just take a moment to think about that. In what way can you envision, and maybe what way are you already, a spiritual warrior? And see who may have some reflection.
For quite a while and had a retreat practice for quite a while. At some point, it occurred to me, and I think it's universal, or maybe that's what I'm saying, that you are practicing not just for yourself. I mean, it occurred to me at some point that, yeah, this is healing for my mother, my community, people who can't get to retreats, people who, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be here practicing. You know, and I don't know if people have a different experience of that, if they are just interested in, oh, I want to accomplish the jhanas and it's all about me. But to me, it didn't evolve that way.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Because there are many, many people who come to the cushion. I think I would have to say, I mean, I'll raise my hand. I'm one of the people who came into Dharma because of my own suffering. And when I first woke up to the fact that, oh my goodness, I can now identify what it is, the causes of it, I began to practice fervently on the cushion. Me, myself, let me free myself. There are many people, especially in Western Buddhism today that we are in, as convert Buddhism, that sit for the satisfaction, freedom, liberation of themselves in a silo. And I find it very, such a beautiful thing to hear you say that that's not been your...
Well, I started that.
Yeah, yeah. Many people do. Some people stay. And so, much like what Larry Yang is saying, that we can awaken together. That there's a collective. You know what happens when you're doing one thing and then four people come and do it with you? It gets a little easier, right? Lifting this up. It'd be easier if two people did it. So it's really, I think it's more important to, it is important to learn on the cushion. And I think it's imperative for us to come off the cushion and into the world and into touching someone else or communicating with somebody else and knowing it's just not for you. I oftentimes say I came to Buddhism because of, not Buddhism, but this particular, because I was a practitioner, but this particular lineage, not for the guarantee of freedom, but for the possibility of it. And so I recognize now today, because I came in this siloed, single person, I'm going to get enlightened, I'm going to levitate, yay, look at me. I now practice to heal generations behind me and to heal future generations. So I applaud you. Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for being a spiritual warrior. Yeah.
For me, I think about some of the the bodhisattvas in my life, and they were the people that showed up with vulnerability and were able to have compassion and witness me. And so what I reflect on is the ability to do that for others too, to be able to show up with humility and really witness people is a way that I can maybe in some small way offer a bodhisattva experience maybe or something.
I think that that's a prescription. That the Buddha put out for us is that sense of vulnerability, of openness, truthfulness. I mean, truthfulness is one of the paramis, one of the 10 perfections, as well as patience and other things. You know, that's a wonderful path towards, to really do some study around the 10 perfections, the paramis, a path to the bodhisattva practice. But I think that's the prescription, is recognizing it in others and knowing how you can be witnessed. Yeah. Bearing witness that I'm not alone in this process, that there are others who are innately good. I see it in every one of you. I see your goodness. I see the seeds that you've planted within yourselves. So I know that there are spiritual warriors amongst us. How do you envision being a spiritual warrior to the benefit of all beings?
Thank you for this talk. I'm really touched by it. I've been crying this whole time because right early in the talk, I understood that I'm in a place where I'm doing that every, you know, all week long, touching people. And yet, I'm so stuck in my own suffering that I can't value it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm not successful in the way that I think I'm supposed to be successful. And that's the
double side of that. What would it feel like to just let go of that expectation of success?
I feel great. Yeah, taking the cloak off.
You know, there's a sense of, I think, what the Buddha asked of us is renunciation. Renouncing that place that we hold so much that we're identified with. Because ultimately it's not about you. Your warriorship is about how you touch others. Success, failure. That's a construct. It's your walk. It's your path. Thank you so much for being a warrior.
Answer your question, because I don't have a plan for being a spiritual warrior. I kind of play it by ear. Things happen, and then you do them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a plan. I just want to put that out.
Okay. And you're doing. Thank you for your warriorship.
sometimes feel the edge of my practice is opening myself to other suffering when they're not necessarily opening themselves to my suffering. And really being able to not only open that, my own heart, but also to be changed by people, wherever they're from, and be open to that. And so taking the blows. Sometimes I feel right now that's part of being a warrior, just being able to open and experience that.
I would ask you to also take care of yourself. The blows are heavy and strong. Those are heavy and strong. Be tender to yourself.
I can relate more to what you said to begin with, which is to touch one person. The idea of being something that for the benefit of all beings, is too grand a goal for me, because I get inundated by all the stuff until I become paralyzed. But I can relate to one person.
Yeah.
And how that affects all beings, I don't know. But when I'm trying, I try to listen to one person and understand what their suffering might be and how I might help, and maybe another person. So I don't know how that benefits all beings, but that's my practice.
What a gift. Thank you.